This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, I sat down for a conversation with a clergyman named William Barber. Reverend Barber is pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And until recently, he was president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. 4 years ago, Reverend Barber led more than 1,000 demonstrators who were arrested for refusing to leave the state legislative building in Raleigh.
Because we have no permanent friends or permanent enemies, only permanent interests rooted in the values of the Constitution. What we stand for is bigger than Republican and Democrat, bigger than liberal and conservative. It's bigger than white and black. It's about what's right.
It was a movement Barber called Moral Mondays. And they were protesting a whole raft of Republican measures having to do with voting rights, gay rights, access to education, environmental protection, and social programs. Moral Mondays made Barber a national figure. He spoke at the Democratic National Convention last summer.
We must shock this nation with the power of love. We must shock this nation with the power of mercy. We must shock this nation and fight for justice for all.
But Barber, a liberal, feels that Democrats and Republicans alike have lost their bearing, that they lack values and a sense of spirituality. Barber has founded a progressive group called Repairers of the Breach, and it focuses on, and I'm quoting here, raising up and repairing our moral infrastructure. We spoke recently at the Public Theater in Manhattan.
Now, you've written, "I can't remember a time when I did not know God both to be real and to be about bringing justice in the world, and yet you had what you call serious reservations about the church." What were those reservations?
Yeah, two different things. I can't remember a time when God, sense of God, was not formative in my reality, but my father did have some struggle, even within the church, the so-called black church, because there were persons who would say to him, "We don't need to be involved in politics. We just need to pray and have praise services and, you know, and just don't be involved." You know, Dr. King faced the same thing. And, you know, Dr. King was put out of his denomination because of that. So I struggled with that. I said, well, maybe I'll be a lawyer, an attorney. And when I got ready to go to college, I actually looked at the catalogs to make sure there weren't any courses on religion required.
You had your fill, you thought?
Well, of that. Not of God, not of justice, not of love, but the formalized kind of. I was hurting, and I was hurting because of some of the things I'd seen. And then somewhere down the line, had a real strong epiphany. And actually, one day I called my father and said, "Daddy, I'm wrestling with something." He said, "Come home, I already know." I said, "You already know what?" He said, "I already know, just come home." And when I went home, we went driving, and he took me down to Nag's Head around the beach, and we just drove along the coast of the ocean and talked. And we talked about, you know, theology. We talked about the church. The church is not a perfect entity. You know, whether or not my work should be inside or outside, the difference between the church as an imperfect entity and the reality of God and the reality of justice, reality of love, and I revealed to him that I felt a calling to ministry, and preached my trial sermon in March of 1984.
Now, the black church writ large has been a sanctuary, a place of truth-telling, a place of relative safety since for hundreds of years. And at the same time, particularly in the South, but not only, the evangelical white church has been growing more and more right-wing now for decades. Now, as a young man, did you start sensing this tension between your own church and the growing moral majority and all the other evangelical movements that were growing?
You've used a lot of terms that I don't use the same way. So it's going to take me a little bit to pat that.
I've got all night.
Okay. First of all, I'm an evangelical. The black church has been traditionally evangelical. The term was hijacked because in the Bible, theologically, there's no such thing as an evangelical that does not begin with a critique of systems of economic injustice. And when Jesus, the ultimate evangelical, right, that brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, that was born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth, the ghetto, right, the poor place, his first sermon said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news." That's evangel. That's what that means. To the poor. If your attention is not on dealing with the issues that hurt the poor, the brokenhearted, the sick, the left out, the least of these, the stranger, and all of those who are made to feel unacceptable, you don't have white right-wing evangelicalism. You have heresy.
Is that what you would call?
Yes. Yeah. You have theological malpractice. It doesn't fit Orthodox Christianity. What we've had.
Let's break it down for a second. How do you account for the fact that Donald Trump, whose behavior and rhetoric and past is in no way a moral avatar, and his interest in religion is of recent vintage, and yet his support was extremely high in that community, broadly defined.
That's right. By that particular group, it was opposed in many ways, but yes, okay. And that's where you see now, I think, where we can see it so clearly. Those, Kevin Cruz in his book, and others have documented this, when they wanted to speak against, for instance, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, and they wanted to take over elements of the Christian pulpit, they came up with this weird theology. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. If you're good, you're wealthy. If you're bad, you're in poverty. It's actually a strange form of Calvinism that just is abusive to Calvinism in itself.
Calvinism with private planes.
No. Right. And so.
Does Creflo Dollar bother you in that way?
Or any of those that simply preach in that way, because it is not consistent with Orthodox theology, it's not consistent with the theology of the Bible, it's not consistent with the critique. But let me make
but
one
how
point.
But how did Trump get such wide
support? Well, that's
support
what I'm saying.
There.
But if in fact, then your theology says whoever is good is wealthy, then you would fawn over a wealthy businessman, right? Because his purse strings.
Despite his moral behavior.
Despite his moral behavior. Because maybe the religion you're promoting isn't really about moral behavior. Maybe it's really a purchased religion, like paid puppets of the empire. Because anytime a religion seems to say the only moral issues are prayer in the school, where you stand on abortion, being against a woman's right to choose, private property, and making sure you can prove that Jesus was a founding member of the NRA, that is not Christianity. Think about it. This is how you can see it, my brother Remley. They're so loud on things like abortion and prayer in the school, and so wrong and so quiet on things like health care and living wages and acceptance of all people and treating the poor. Now, there are 3,500 scriptures in the Bible about love and justice and mercy and how you treat the stranger and how you help the least of these. And it's not talking about private charity either. It's talking about how we shape society. It's talking about the nations. Jesus said, "When I will say to the nations when I was hungry," not to individual, to the nation. That's governments. 3,500 scriptures. There may be three scriptures about homosexuality. None of them trump the scripture that says you got to love your neighbor as yourself. So how do you claim to be a conservative if you dismiss 3,500 texts, but then build a whole theology around three scriptures and most of them you misinterpret? That's not conservative. That's not, because conservative means to hold on to the essence of.
How do you deal with a complex moral issue like abortion in your church, where I would bet there's not unanimity in the pews?
It's not unanimity. First of all, one of the things we say to people is, first of all, let's get the folk out of the room for a minute. We love them. But who want to come in here and talk about a woman's right to choose, and they claim they want the baby to be here, but then they don't want to give the woman health care to get the baby here, or health care to the baby after the baby gets here. They don't want to pay the parents a living wage so they can take care. So you really don't have any credibility to talk about abortion, because all of your policies abort people's possibilities, dreams, and hope. So you just, you don't need to be in this conversation. Secondly, it's easy. You can be, I'm not pro-abortion. You know, like, man, say, go, just go out. And that's not even, we shouldn't, it's not pro or con. I can say that I believe in life. I want persons to have children. But there are so many situations where that may not be possible. There are situations where people have to choose. And even if they choose to have an abortion, I choose to love. I choose to care for them. What I want to get is get the conversation to higher ground. And the higher ground is, how do we stop aborting the hopes of the poor? How do we stop destroying healthcare? You think about just a few weeks ago, the hypocrisy of having clergy in the Rose Garden with the president clapping for him signing an executive order about so-called religious leaders and not chastising him on his position to deny millions of people health care. And they claim to be Christian clergy. Now watch this. This is a very simple country boy analogy. If I'm not mistaken, the one thing Jesus did was set up free health clinics. I mean, everywhere you look in the Bible, Jesus healing folk. He never charged a leper a copay. Now, you believe in Jesus now. You believe in Jesus. But you're going to applaud someone? Something else is going on underneath that that's ugly, that's cynical, that doesn't make sense, that's not good for the health of our culture, and as a denial of the basics of our faith. You know, the word salvation means healing.
Reverend, your most recent book is called The Third Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. In it, you argue that this country needs what you call a third reconstruction in order to save the soul of America. Tell me what you mean by that.
I actually believe that much of what we're seeing, we're in the birth pains of a third reconstruction, and those who are the adversaries of America reconstructing itself, and who in many ways are the social and political descendants of those who've always fought Reconstruction, they see it happening. If you know history, you understand that what we've seen with Donald Trump is as American as apple pie. It's the call and response of history. The call is more justice, more racial progress. The response is the progress of racism, the fear, and the reaction. And what should surprise us is not so much that Donald Trump used these tactics, but that he and others, Ryan McConnell and others, have been so successful at using them in the 21st century. And one of the reasons I've been writing about the Third Reconstruction is because I think too often too many people do not know this history. Do not know this history.
You think we're too caught up in the day-to-day hysteria of what's going on?
Sometimes, and just, we keep dumbing down politics. We need to understand this history because actually we're seeing it played out. What do we have now? The cry against for tax cuts. What helped to bring it into the second Reconstruction? Cry about tax cut. First Reconstruction, the cry about tax cuts, because the tax cut was always about disabling the government from being able to make the playing field more level and fixing the problems that the government created in the first place.
So this brings us to your role. Now, you've just changed your life a little bit. You've left your job in the North Carolina NAACP.
I laugh when you say job because I see some
it's
folks.
Work.
It's a volunteer. You know, people don't realize that. The president
it's
of the
work,
NAACP is work, but it's volunteer. It's purely love, volunteer.
But it's been replaced by something that's potentially much larger, which is to lead a poor people's movement. What does that movement mean?
First of all, last year, from April to November, I did a tour with Dr. James Forbes, former emeritus, pastor emeritus of Riverside, Dr. Liz Theo Harris from Union, Sister Simone Tracy Blackman. We did 22 states, called it the Moral Revival Tour, and we put out a higher ground moral agenda. Thousands of people showed up. Hundreds of clergy activists, even people who are not people of faith but who believe in the moral arc of the universe, showed up to be trained in moral activism, moral articulation, and moral analysis. It showed us that there was a heart that people know we need, as I said, the convention, some moral defibrillators, people who are willing to say, wait a minute, some of these issues are not about left versus right, they're about right versus wrong. Healthcare is about right versus wrong. Living wage is right versus wrong. Dealing with systemic racism is about right versus wrong. And that we need to stand up not as partisans, but as people of conscience. Then the election happened. Now, we had already decided, regardless of who was elected, we needed a Poor People's Campaign. And the reason is, we had 26 presidential debates, I think, maybe 27. Now, think about it. Not one debate, not one full debate on voting rights. At a time.
Or the poor.
Right, it's a whole list. Not one full debate where the name, the poor, was used. Not one full debate on the war economy. Not one full debate on public education. None. We were talking about text messages, emails, innuendos, and this strange conversation that you will not hear anywhere else in the world, how to take health care. That says to us, we don't have just a partisan problem. We have a deep moral malady. Something's wrong in the spirit of the country. And we knew that we needed to have this Poor People's Campaign. So we decided, when it comes to prophetic voices, Brother Remnant, you don't simply have commemorations of what they did. I'm kind of tired of commemorations now. Well, we go back and say, back then they did this. You figure out how to reimagine and re-engage what they did and what was the unfinished business.
You've had a movement called the Moral Monday Movement, mm-hmm. as of 2013, I believe.
Actually, the Forward Together Moral Movement started in 2007 when Democrats were in office. And I want to talk about that because a moral movement can't just challenge extremists who've taken over the Republican Party. We have to challenge reluctant Democrats. And especially right now, I'm very concerned when I hear Democrats talking only about the middle class. They think that's all that went wrong in this past election. One of the things we have to do is recover our moral foundation. When some of these extremists say they want to read the Constitution, I get happy. I said, please, let's read the Constitution. Or when they say we wanna talk about what's in the Bible, please, let's have that conversation. Because if we have it, then it will expose the holes in the hypocrisy and may even cause you to repent.
Reverend Barber,
come join us in love.
The church, and not only the black church, mm-hmm. but the church and religion. Mm-hmm. were a huge impetus to the civil rights movement. And there were lots of leaders of the civil rights movement, lots of factions and differences of opinion, all the rest. Is the church in the same position that it was in 1954 through the late 60s now to be that moral underpinning? When I went, I was in Charleston, South Carolina after those terrible murders mm-hmm. and spent a lot of time at that church. But when I spoke to younger people in Black Lives Matter movement, it was well outside the church structure. There was a real gap between the older folks in the church, and distinctly older, mm-hmm. and the younger movement that was well outside the church. Is that a complication for today's movement?
Well, you know, I'd like love you to talk to all the young people that are part of the Moral Monday movement, and many of them are Black Lives Matter and many other groups. See, I have, again, we're having a little linguistic thing, because to say the church has always been problematic. You know, the church has always been problematic.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Is the progressive movement, broadly defined, more secular than it was a half century ago?
I think that progressives made a mistake when they walked away from the centerpieces of faith and morality because they were mad with Jerry Falwell You know, I think progressives make a mistake when we don't know and remember the power of moral underpinning and what power has been. Now, I'm not talking about a movement that says you have to be Christian. That's the genius of the Moral Monday movement. There are people in who are atheists that come to our rallies and say, amen. What we found is that there are these deep moral foundations that transcend our limits. They transcend our limits. We have figured out a way in North Carolina, and what we figured out on the moral revival, if you look at the groups that came and at all our revivals, we had Black Lives Matter, we had, you know, environmentalists, we had Fight for 15. In fact, one time in Birmingham, we were in a Jewish synagogue downtown training 200 activists. We had Muslims, Christians, Jews in a Jewish synagogue, Black Lives Matter, people not of faith, charismatics, policy people, gay and straight, all in the same room all day long. And I think that we make a big mistake. When I see progressives now, and I love so many of them, talking about all we got to do is work on the white work middle class. And they're not talking about expanding the electorate. When they give every reason for this election, but without dealing with the issue of race. You know, I've said to a group the other day on this election, if you know the history of Reconstruction, not only do you know what has happened as an American as apple pie, you know how to defeat it. It's when we come together, when we're willing to put our minds to work and our bodies on the line. What if we didn't focus on Trump, because Trump is a symptom? What if we went up to McConnell's office and Ryan's office and every state capital? And what if we said this is not the end of a movement, but a launch in the movement? And what if we said we will work in our silos sometimes, but we want you to know we're all in this together and we stand on our deepest moral principles and not just curse the darkness, but point people to the light? What if we use something like that to literally shock the very heart of this nation? I want to see what would happen if we finished that leg of the Poor People's Campaign. I want to see what would happen if we could come together. And I believe Walter Wink was a great theologian at Union Theological Seminary. He wrote a sermon I remember reading some years ago called The Blessings of an Enemy. Now, this is going to sound strange. Don't y'all get mad. Let me finish. Sometimes you have to look at what your enemy did to defeat you to find your strength. If the forces in this last election, this is not just this last election, this has been a 40-year battle. If, however, in order to win, they had to lie almost every other 10 minutes, they had to find a way to put pornographic sums of money into the electoral pot. They had to spend years pushing voter suppression. They had to use fear against Muslims, against immigrants. They had to be helped by the media that played too long with Trump and gave him too much free press. And then they had to go all the way over to Russia and get help. If somebody cheats you, they don't cheat you because you're weak. People only cheat you when they can't beat you in a fair fight. Then that says that we are stronger than we realize. And this is not the worst thing we've ever faced. People made it through slavery. People made it through the denial of women's rights. People made it through the depression in this country. People made it through apartheid and Jim Crow. It's our time to stand up and be the moral dissenters, the moral defibrillators, and the moral dreamers, and to make it through this moment and use it to change the course of history, to change America. And in some ways, if we work together, we'll change the world.
Reverend Barber, thank you. Thank you very much. Reverend Dr. William Barber, President of Repairers of the Breach.
The
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.